paper.
Welcome to episode 84 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artists' books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio. And I run an online membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Radha Pandey, a papermaker and letterpress printer. She earned her MFA in book arts from the University of Iowa Center for the Book, where she studied letterpress printing, bookbinding, and papermaking, with a focus on Western, Eastern, and Indo-Islamic papermaking techniques. Her artist books are held in numerous public collections. She has lectured and taught workshops on Indo-Islamic papermaking around the world, and she is currently working on an artist book inspired by Mughal miniature paintings of botanicals from the 17th century. Radha splits her time between India, where she grew up, and Norway, where she and her partner, Johan Solberg, run Halden Bookworks. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Radha Pandey, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, and I'm looking forward to hearing about your journey with paper. So you're quite international, and we'll get into all of that, but tell me a little bit about childhood influences that were creative and maybe have led you to finding paper or art.
Sure.
And where you grew up.
Yeah, I could say, well, I grew up in Delhi, mm-hmm. in India, mm-hmm. And spent most of my growing up years there. And my biggest creative influence was my family. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in my family indulge in creative uh-huh. things. So my grandmother was an oil painter, and I used uh-huh. to watch her paint a lot. My mom is a puppeteer.
Oh.
And she once traveled to Japan to teach a puppetry workshop. And when she came back, she brought back washi. And I just thought that was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
Uh-huh.
And so it was like love at first sight, except it was paper. And I thought, I have to try making this. So I kept trying to make washi using newspaper.
Uh-huh.
Oh. Never quite got there. So it was disappointing, but it also opened up the world of paper making for me. Like, I didn't know you could make paper, right?
Right. And how did you make that connection that, like, why did you think to make paper when you saw the washi? Did your mother tell you it was made by hand, or had you seen paper being made?
I hadn't. She told me that it was made by hand.
Oh.
And she, because she was making a lot of pulp and other material to make her larger than life puppets.
Right.
One of the things that came very naturally to her was to just, pulverize newspaper to make all of her masks and things like that.
Okay.
So we always had a ton of newspaper lying around, and she said, this is how you would do it. And you would just take a sieve from the kitchen and try to make a sheet, and it worked.
Right. Right. But obviously the newspaper was not making the thin, beautiful sheets that you saw in that washi.
No, uh-huh. It was a far cry, but it was just fun to actually transform something like a newspaper that was of literally no value to me as a little kid mm-hmm. into something that I had made myself that was, to me, beautiful at the time, and that I could use for my own artwork, you know. Draw on or paint on or whatever.
Right. Wow. And tell me a little more about the puppetry. Like, your mother traveled. Did she just build the puppets? Did she, and how were they used? Was she involved in that part too? Or
yeah, she did a lot of street performances in Delhi when she was pregnant with me and after when I was a kid too. Mm-hmm. And she, a lot of the performances were about social justice issues and domestic violence and AIDS and things like that. And taking those messages to the street through puppetry and theater. And so we always had puppets around the house, and a lot of our bedtime stories involve these puppets.
Ah.
And we all had our favorites. And in the meantime, my father still was and still is a documentary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Films on wildlife in India. And so we spend a lot of time in the forest just sitting and waiting for something to happen so he could capture it on film.
Uh-huh.
And so that kind of tuned me into this aspect of what I deal with now in my work, which is a lot to do with nature and the environment and paying attention, close attention to things.
Right. Wow. Okay. So did you, what was like school like for you? Were there a lot of was there creativity, art classes, music?
I was in the school choir and we had an art class, but it was not what you would think of as an art class if you compare it to anywhere else in the world. So that wasn't, I didn't really see those as outlets for me at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very active in, we had to put together performance once a month as a class. And so I was very much involved in trying to help make the sets or do stuff backstage and that kind of thing.
Mm.
So anything that involved making something with my hands, involving cutting out pieces of paper and, you know, creating images was what I would just like jump at the chance and try to get involved with that.
Right, right. And then you went on to university and you studied, what did you study?
I went to do my undergraduate in Bangalore in South India, and I studied graphic design. And my final sort of thesis project ended up being an animation that I made using paper, handmade paper. So in our last year, we were meant to do an internship that would hopefully turn into our thesis. So I decided to intern at a paper mill in Oroville.
Right. And tell me a little bit about Oroville. I've heard about it. And actually, there's a video of your animation on your website, which is, it looks a little puppet-like.
Yeah, yeah. So I was trying to bring in those influences to puppetry and film, and then made this animation. Oroville is a small colony of settlers that came to India from all over the world in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And built this almost like a commune in South India. And it's still there. It still exists. And there are still people moving there from all over. And people come with all kinds of skills. And so, you know, Oroville is known for its architects, its ceramics, its paper, its incense. So everything is done in-house, but a lot of it is marketed abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And because a lot of people come from Europe, you often find products from Oroville in Europe.
Ah, okay. Okay. Cool. Okay, yeah. So you went did an internship?
Yeah, I did an internship. And the reason I decided to pursue it was because I ended up going to Haystack while I was in my undergraduate program.
Okay.
And learned papermaking from Catherine Nash.
Right. And how did you get to Haystack?
It was a crazy, like something that you read about in a book that never happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was one of those things. It was just Haystack was offering a scholarship to any one student in a design school or art school in India per year.
Mm-hmm.
And schools would enroll, and then students would, you know, volunteer to be picked. And so one day our teacher announced, oh, we're part of this program. And if you have the means to travel to the United States, you can put your name in this hat.
Oh.
And they picked my name. They talked a bit about Haystack. After they picked my name, I said, I'm going to go look up this place and see see what they offer.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it was Japanese Papermaking That Summer by Catherine Nash. And I thought, that's the one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it was pretty, it was like everything aligned to make sure that I went there and met all these people and met Catherine, who then put me in touch with a lot of other paper makers and people that she thought that I would like to meet. One of them was Asao Shimura in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
So after I graduated and after I'd done my Auroville training too, I went to the Philippines to meet him and spend time with him and see what he was up to. And so it really changed my relationship with the material and opened up this whole world of paper makers that I didn't know existed.
Right, right. And at Auroville, what style of papermaking were they doing?
It was what you would consider European style, except using an auto vat.
Okay.
Which is a semi-manual, semi-automatic machine.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't require any great skill to make paper that way. You just require the machine and someone willing to do it.
And the autovat originated in India, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Around the time of independence, 1945-ish.
Okay. Cool. Okay, so yeah, you were on the paper path. Paper bit you. And
yeah.
How long did you spend with Asao? And now Asao is Japanese, but he's lived in the Philippines for a long time. And yeah, tell me a little bit about what you did there.
Yeah, I was just there for 2 weeks. We'd only been in touch on email.
Mm-hmm.
And then he suddenly invited me to come to the Philippines out of the blue. And I just said yes, because Philippines and Asao.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and it was pretty unclear what I was going to do. But he said that he would just show me how he makes paper.
Mm-hmm.
And show me something about natural pigments and teach me about konnyaku. And so that's what we spent 2 weeks doing, was me just watching him make paper. And then he showed me all the paper that he made over the years, showed me his pigments. And we made a lot of paper together. And we did a lot of work with konnyaku and just learning how to use konnyaku, learn how he uses konnyaku as a paper treatment. So that's what I did there, 2 weeks.
Right. And just describe what konnyaku is for people who don't know.
It's also called the devil's root or devil's tongue. Some mm-hmm. people call it the hat.
That's...
And it's a tuber.
Right.
And you can take out the tuber when it's fully mature and dry it and crush it into a powder, slice it, dry it, cut, crush it into a fine powder. And then when you mix it with water, it becomes like a sticky translucent paste. And when it's applied to paper, it gives paper wet strength. So what we did as a test to test this wet strength was to actually cook food in a bowl made out of this paper.
Ah.
And so he had this table made for it, especially with a table with a hole in it.
Uh-huh.
He put the paper in there, he put some broth in it and lit a fire underneath and just cooked this soup. And the paper did not catch fire and nothing leaked through. And we had a great soup in the end.
It was fantastic. And it stayed the shape of the bowl.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And traditionally in Japan, I think konnyaku was used to treat paper and then crumpled to make momigami, a paper cloth.
Yeah, so, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so then what happened? I know you ended up at the University of Iowa. How did that sort of transpire?
So that happened again in some twisted way because of Haystack.
Uh-huh.
So I went back to Haystack as an assistant to Beatrice Caron. She's a paper cutter.
Yeah.
So I was in her class and I met Kerry Cushman, who actually that's incorrect. I wasn't her assistant. Kerry was her assistant.
Okay.
And I went back just to attend Beatrice's class because I was really interested in that, what she was doing in her work. And so Kerry told me about the Friends of Dart Hunter conference, which was happening at Aramont that later that year.
Oh.
And she said, instead of doing this thing, which is what I was doing at the time, which was traveling to different places to meet different paper makers in the United States, why don't you just go to the conference and you'll meet everybody in one place and mm-hmm. you'll save some money. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And at the conference, I met Tim Barrett, who I wanted to talk to because I wanted to go to Japan. That was my ultimate aim.
Okay.
My goal, go to Japan and learn Japanese papermaking and, you know, achieve the thing that I set out to do when I was five.
Yeah.
And he said, why do you want to go to Japan when you can come to Iowa and study not only Japanese papermaking, but all of these other things? And consider applying to the program. So that's what I did. And I got in and I decided to just go for it, move to Iowa.
Okay, wow. So what years were you in Iowa?
2011 to 2014.
Okay. And the University of Iowa is an amazing papermaking facility and the Center for the Book. And so what was your focus there?
Initially, it was going to be papermaking and Japanese papermaking. And then I got sucked into the rest of the book arts umbrella mm-hmm. and got very, very interested in bookbinding and letterpress printing and making artist books. And so eventually my focus became making books from paper that I'd made. Mm-hmm. And making paper specifically for the kinds of books that I wanted to make. And in doing so, I started doing a lot of work with Indo-Islamic papermaking and learning more about the history of papermaking in India. And that was one of the things that we learned at the program. And so I wanted to just also foster that as part of me being there. So try to do as much research as possible, try to get an article written and published, and try to find as many resources as possible. So Alexandra Sotiru's entire collection of photographs and notes is in the University of Iowa Special Collections library. So that was one of the things that I also referred to in order to build on that.
Right. And I know you traveled and did some research in India. Was that just on trips home or was that part of your studies or both?
Yeah, that was just on a trip home. Mm-hmm. My mother, again, played another pivotal role. Uh-huh. She was at another kind of conference type thing where she was telling someone that her daughter is studying papermaking and trying to find these traditional papermakers in India and hasn't been able to. And the person she was talking to happened to be an artist who uses traditionally made Indian paper for her work.
Mm.
And she knew the papermakers.
Right.
And so we got the address because these kind of things weren't available online at that time
mm-hmm.
or in the Yellow Pages or anything. So it was just word of mouth. So luckily we got an address, and when I came back to India that winter, we rented a car and went to that village and met with the papermakers and talked with them. And yeah, I just felt so lucky that it was again some really strange turn of fate that made our paths cross. And I'm still in touch with them. Mm-hmm. I wrote an article about that family. They're one of seven known surviving families in India practicing the craft today.
Wow.
And it's almost the same as it was being done in the 14th century. So it's really, really special.
Oh, yeah. And where did that article appear?
In Hand Papermaking Magazine, winter 2012 issue.
Okay, great. And I know you also... you have a talk on your website that you gave, and you've spoken more than once about papermaking in India. And I think your talk has evolved over the years, which is really cool. So listeners, you can go to Radha's website and see her talk about more in depth about papermaking in India, because it's fascinating. Okay. Well, tell me about some of your artist books and how the paper integrates. And I'm particularly interested in paper and light. I think we share that, and watermarks. And so maybe tell me about one of your first projects.
Yeah, sure. One of the first ones was called Abies Spectabilis. And it's one of the first books that I made, for which I made all the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I realized what a big undertaking that was at the time, to make all the paper and right. then to paint on all of it. And it taught me a lot about, you know, the material I was using, which was abaca, and then how that would react to wet ink and trying to print quite a big print on a big sheet of abaca, which wasn't the best sheet of abaca. I mean, you know, those sheets, because of the length of time I'd beaten them for, were as cloudy as abaca usually is.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a big learning experience for me, but it did cement the fact that I felt like I was on the right track and I wanted to continue making paper for my projects. And the reason I chose it for that project was because the book is about a species of fir, and it recounts the experience of me being in a fir forest and just the sounds that day and the light and the temperature and everything. And I thought that the sound that the abaca made when you turned the pages really recalled that feeling for me.
Right.
So that was the reason I chose it. And I thought those two fit really well.
Yeah. Tell me the name of that book again.
Yeah, it's called Abies Spectabilis.
That's why I couldn't. Abies Spectabilis.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's on your website?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. And did you edition that, or was that just one?
Yeah, I editioned it. It was an edition of 20, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you've done many artist book editions. I was really interested in the work you've done with watermarking and animation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that work really sucked away so much of my time.
Yeah.
Trying to figure that out and crack that. And it was, I decided to do that after we did a reading in Tim's class about animation, about watermarks, something that Dard Hunter had written. I think it's called 600 Years of Watermarks or something like that.
Yeah.
I remember reading it, and there was a long description about creating a watermark for a banknote in England.
Mm-hmm.
And just reading the intensity with which people pursued creating the perfect watermark for a banknote, something that people don't even notice anymore, just made me feel really inspired. And I thought, you know what, I should try to do one, and try to bring in the same kind of grit or the same kind of enthusiasm into this, but in today's age. And one of the ways that I could think of doing that was by creating a stop motion animation, because that's something I knew how to do. And I wanted to combine it with something new that I'd learned, which is watermark.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a while trying to find the right materials to do that with. I first started the traditional way with copper and made a few frames using copper, and then realized that my skills were just not going to cut it to make a good looking animation by the end.
So you mean copper wire? To make the watermark. So the traditional way watermarks were made. Okay.
That's right. So soldering pieces of copper wire.
Mm-hmm.
So getting each, if I wanted just 1 second, I would need at least 25 of them.
Wow.
And so getting each of those to look exactly the same with my skills using copper wire, not going to happen.
Right.
So I try to use a bunch of other non-traditional materials like puffy paint and, sticky back adhesive backed materials that Carriage House has, Buttercut and things like that too.
Right.
But in the end, I went with Delrin that was laser cut and came up with systems to have the watermarks in the same place on each sheet So making registration devices too was a part of that learning. So in the end, I made that 1 second animation that was 25 frames. And then I made another one, which is an image of trees with birds sitting on top and then all the birds fly off. And so that was another bit of a learning curve because all the birds are like little islands that have to be almost in the same place with every successive frame. And so trying to figure out how to register that after you take off the Deldrin from the mold surface, after you make each sheet, was a bit of a challenge. But we figured it out. And so for that 4 second animation, I made about 150 sheets because for each image, I made about 4 to 8 sheets of paper, just because not each sheet was perfect. And in some areas, it was too thin. Some of the watermarked areas were really wide. So I had to squeeze in pulp a lot of the time.
Right. And so
if you look at the animation at the end, you'll see like a lot of movement in the trunks because of me filling it up with pulp. But it was fun.
They're beautiful, the animations, listeners. You definitely have to look. And yeah, I do a lot of watermarking, so I can sympathize with the, it's really hard to get a good looking sheet, especially if you're going to illuminate it, which is what you did. So yeah, how did you produce? You took still shots of each sheet of paper. You picked out the 25 best sheets, I guess.
Yeah, 25 times 4. Right. So I picked out 100. Oh, so I probably made a lot more sheets, but I picked out 25 per second good sheets. And then I, again, I had to make a little jig so that they all kind of aligned.
Right.
And I backlit them and took still shots. And then I strung it together in Adobe After Effects.
Right.
And that itself was, you know, it was much easier in some ways, but it was also difficult because you could really see that each sheet was a slightly different size because of how I couched it or how it stretched when it dried or something or the other.
Right.
So I ended up aligning it by its midpoint instead of on its edges, which is what I'd initially thought I would do.
Oh, interesting. That just reminds me of, I took this little origami class last night with Michael LaFosse, who does wet folding. And he had us wet the sheet of origami paper and talked about how it stretches in one direction because of the grain. So when you fold it, like you have to fold a diagonal on the origami. Usually it all lines up when the paper is dry, but when it's wet, that one edge stretches. So he had this technique of making it right. So, so interesting. All these little subtle things.
Yeah.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about the Paper Year, my online membership club, which is now open for registration. This is an annual subscription club, kind of like a year-long online class, featuring a new paper project every month. Get inspired with video tutorials and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating all month long. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative community. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more and sign up. The first project of 2022 will deliver on January 3rd, and as soon as you sign up, you'll have access to the library of past projects. Now back to our conversation.
So I know you met your partner at the University of Iowa, and now you guys have this Halden Bookworks in Norway. Tell me a little bit about what he does, his name, all that.
Yeah, Johan. we actually met at PBI.
Oh, PBI. Okay.
Yeah, and then he enrolled in Iowa as a student.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was another weird coincidence.
Okay, PBI is the Paper and Book Intensive, which is an amazing 2 week long summer camp for book and paper professionals. Yeah.
Yeah. In Michigan.
Okay. Yeah.
So his name is Johan Solberg, and he is a trained fine binder. And after University of Iowa, he is also well-versed in all the things that I do. But before he got there, he decided, he had read Tim's book as a student, mm-hmm. a binding student, and he decided to just go to Japan and study Japanese papermaking for 6 months with a papermaker there.
Oh.
And so he actually went in winter, which is a strange choice, but that's what he did. He went in winter and studied Japanese papermaking. So that was his primary reason to go to the University of Iowa to study with Tim okay. and learn everything else too. And so after he graduated and I was done teaching, we decided to set up a studio, a book art studio in Norway, which is where he's from.
Mm-hmm.
And our studio is in Halden, which is close to the border, our Swedish border.
Okay.
And it's an old cotton factory that was bought by a group of artists over 10 years ago. And he was one of the artists that invested in that building. And so we invested in a little more space in that building and decided to extend the bindery that he had already built and add on a paper studio and a print studio and a small living space. And so our initial plan was to live there and work there and teach from there and have people come and teach there as well. But now we've decided not to live there anymore. We just use it as our studio.
Okay. And you moved there. How much before COVID hit did you, and you've been renovating, and I mean, I'm sure COVID sort of stalled some of your plans there.
Yeah, we moved there pretty early. So
okay.
I think it was 2017. Okay. And then when COVID hit, I was in Delhi and Johan was in Norway. And we were apart for almost a year.
Mm.
Then I managed to come here
mm-hmm.
in the middle of June in 2019, I think. Now I've lost complete track of time.
2020, because COVID was in 2020. I don't know.
Yeah, but Delhi was locked down. Delhi earlier. Was... Are we in 2021?
Yeah.
Okay, I've been in Norway now for a year and a half. So okay. whatever that means, that's when all I right. came back.
Yeah.
And we couldn't work on our studio during that entire period because of not being able to travel anywhere and both places being in lockdown and not having any work because all the work that we do and the money that we earn just goes into our studio.
Mm-hmm.
And so we finally did make some headway this year when things eased up in Norway a little bit. So we finished our print studio space.
Mm-hmm.
And right before all of this happened, we managed to get someone to drill a drain in our what would be our paper studio.
Uh-huh.
And so we finally have, you know, our paper studio set up. The only thing that we want to do early before summer next year is to get the floor waterproofed.
Ah, okay. Okay.
So yeah, we're just doing everything in stages. It's on the fifth floor, so we have to really get it well sealed so nothing leaks.
Right, right. My first experience with paper making was at Dudonnet Paper Mill in New York, and okay. they were in yeah. a different location than they are now, and they were on the fifth floor.
Oh.
And one time I got blamed. It probably was my fault for leaving the water on. Somehow like a hose had fallen and, you know, engaged. And yeah, then it leaked below to the floor below. And we got a call from the people that lived down there. But yeah, it's possible. Other than that, we didn't get complaints that I know of.
Okay.
Wow. Wow. So does Johan do binding for other people?
Yeah, he does commission binding. He does a lot of paper and book conservation work.
Okay.
That's his bread and butter.
Right. All right. And so you continue to make your artist books and you do several other things. I think you make commission paper and you teach. Just tell me a little bit about your oeuvre.
Sure. So yeah, I do commission paper for people's projects. Mm-hmm. If I can, and if I have the time and if they have patience, because sometimes it takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
So an example of that is a French conservator working in Netherlands on Islamic bindings wanted a paper made in the Indo-Islamic style using fermented hemp. And so it took 6 weeks to ferment the hemp and then, you know, make the paper and then match the color. And so after about 3 months, she got her paper. So right. that's one of the commissions that I did this year.
Tell me a little about the Indo-Islamic style. What makes it unique? Yeah.
Yeah. So what makes it unique is that the vat is a dugout vat. It's dug into the ground,
mm-hmm.
traditionally anyway. Mm-hmm. And the hemp, the fiber that's used is hemp, or sometimes they think flax. Sometimes people mm-hmm. also say that cotton was also used. And then the papermaker assumes a squatting position.
Right.
And the tools look very similar to the Korean papermaking tools, except they have two sticks on either end and two dowels on either end of the screen. Oh. And instead of being portrait, it's a landscape format. Uh-huh. And so if you look at any videos or images online of Vietnamese papermaking or papermaking in Burma or Bhutan, it looks very, very similar.
Oh, okay.
And it's generally one dip, and you don't lift the mold up off the surface. You let it sit on top of the surface while you distribute the fibers, and then you pick up the mold. And so then the fiber starts draining. So you actually have a lot of time, work time, open time to make your sheet as nice as possible. And then in some cases, paper makers do a second dip on top of that first dip. So that's another thing that makes it unique, is this dipping twice technique mm-hmm. without disrupting the layer that's already been laid down. And then just like Japanese, Korean, and Chinese papermaking and Vietnamese papermaking techniques, traditionally there was no interfacing in between. So just the edge of the sheet would be folded to make a thicker lifting edge.
Mm-hmm.
And then sheets would be couched one on top of the other and then pressed slowly over time.
When was that folding done? When it's still on the screen or?
When it's still on the screen right okay. before it's couched. And the other thing that makes it stand out are the finishing techniques. So after the paper is completely dry, it's because some raw hemp is used and, you know, some recycled materials could also be used. There might be fibers that are sticking up out of the sheet that haven't been digested by the fermentation or the cooking process. So the finished sheets that are dried against a polished wall are lightly sanded using the kneecap of a camel. And then they're wheat starch sized externally, and then they're polished or burnished using an agate stone.
Wow. Okay. And what was the beading process? Did I miss that? Or did you like the pulp initially, how it was?
So traditionally,
after fermenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Traditionally it was beaten using wooden trip hammers, mm-hmm. but not with a water wheel with people on the other end. So it was one trip hammer per trough, and there would be two people on one end holding it up and then jumping off so that the hammer would collapse on the other end. So that was the beating process traditionally. Today they use a Hollander beater, and then some stamping is also done just using one's feet.
Mm-hmm.
So recycled paper is put into a pit, and then they add water and lime, and then they get into the pit and just pulverize it and then add it to the raw hemp.
Okay. Wow. Fascinating. And so when you made this paper. Did you use a Hollander?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the papermaking equipment at your studio. And I think you have residents, people, or do you have people signed up to come? I know we're still just coming out of COVID. So, but a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'll start with the what's in the paper studio. So we have a Hollander beater, like a standard Rena, beautiful stainless steel beater, which is our pride and joy. and we now have a drain, so water can go down the drain.
Right.
We have two professional Japanese molds, Sugetas. We have one very, very big laid European mold, which is probably 33 by 48 inches or something huge and impossible. And then we have a number of smaller sizes of Western molds as well, laid molds. And then we have a couple of self-made Indo-Islamic screens and frames to go with it, as well as a Korean frame and screen. And then we have student-grade versions of everything except the Korean frame, so that we can teach any of those techniques. And yeah, the studio is open for workshops, which we hope to hold over the summer and later on when it's actually nice to be in the studio, otherwise it's freezing cold. And we also hope to host artists who want to do residencies there, whether it's related to paper making or bookbinding or letterpress printing or any combination thereof, starting next year.
And will that be like, will they have to have any kind of experience, or do you and Johan plan on like being technical assistants? Or I'm just curious how you, will it be on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, we planned on people who have some experience, so that people, when they apply, are applying with a project, and that gives us an idea of what kind of space and equipment they'll be using and how familiar they are with it. And that'll kind of determine how available we are. If it's somebody very independent, then I don't want to be in their way. I'd just rather let them use the space as they see fit. But if it's someone that needs help, we'll obviously be there.
Right. And you mentioned that you were living there for a while. So is there a place for them, a resident, to live, or do they live offsite, or they can choose?
Yeah, they can choose. There's a nice room that we built for ourselves and a bathroom on the same floor. But a couple of artists that are in the building built a quote-unquote hotel there with 6 rooms and a kitchen and everything. And so residents can even stay there if they want.
So this, yeah, I've seen a picture of the outside. It's a big building. How many other artists are involved in this?
There are 10 other people.
Okay.
And there's one book artist who makes one-of-a-kind books, but everybody else works with, there's one person who works with seaweed, there's one person that works with sound, there's one person that does photography, so it's all kinds of people.
Right. Cool. Yeah. All right, so that's Halden Bookworks in Norway. and I know that you... well, I'm guessing you moved to Norway because Johan had that building, but you still travel to India. You have family there. And I know you've been planning to do a tour, but I think that's been thwarted by COVID. So tell me about the plans for that. That sounds really exciting.
Yeah. So we travel there every year when it gets too cold in Norway for me. So we're trying to do 6 months and 6 months because Johan's family is here and my family's there, and neither of us want to compromise on that. And so one of the things that I'm really passionate about is trying to bring people to India and trying to show people that there is a book art scene in India, and it's very ancient, and there are people still involved in all the aspects of the art of the book in India today. And so the tour is designed around that, showing people these skills and having craftspeople that are still working in these fields to teach workshops with the people that are on tour. So it's not just a let's go to this person's studio and see how they do this, but also let's learn how to do this from a person that's living here, that knows and does it day in and day out. And then that's mixed in with some cultural things like dance performances and theater and things like that. And the first time that we did it, we did have, like the trip to Taj Mahal that everybody insists on seeing.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think it's just going to be, if people want to do it, we'll help them organize it. But I don't think it'll be part of the main event because that's really not what it's focusing on.
Right. And how long is the tour?
It's 14 days and 15 nights or something like that.
Okay. And people can find out about it on your website?
Yeah.
And what is the website?
RadhaPandey.com.
Okay. Yeah. And we'll link to that in the show notes. And you're planning to go when? When is the next one?
It's at the end of next year. So it'll be December, January.
Of 2022.
Of 2022. Yeah. So it'll be 2022, 23.
Okay. Fantastic. Wow. And okay. And you teach some.
Yeah, that's right.
In the studio, on Zoom, around the world. Tell me, give me an overview of your teaching and what you teach, because you teach unique things. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So I was teaching for a while at the University of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching papermaking and covering all the aspects of papermaking.
Mm-hmm.
And what I teach when I teach workshops is usually Indo-Islamic papermaking and natural dyeing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my two favorites in a way, mm-hmm. because they go really well together. And I really love going into the history of the craft in both cases and bringing that into the classroom and talking more about that aspect. And so in this COVID time, I haven't been able to actively teach any papermaking online. So I've been transitioning to natural dyeing, which is easy to do online, mm-hmm. as well as things like encaustic treatments for paper, which is something that I use for a lot of my artist books.
Mm.
So for people that work with paper, how can you transform it using encaustic wax and things like that? So it's kind of a range. Thanks to natural dyes, I also got into making pigments and making lake pigments and then using pigments on paper. And so that's another thing that I started teaching.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, one thing just leads to the other.
Right, right. And I love the images of the naturally dyed papers on your website. So rich, rich colors, beautiful. Okay, and what are you working on now? Are you working on a new artist book?
Yeah, I have been working on it for about 3 years now. It's a book that's been inspired by Mughal floral portraiture from the 17th century. So the Mughal period in India, you can say it's kind of like the medieval period, although not really.
Mm-hmm.
It was also like a Renaissance. And so I'm looking at the portraiture of nature during that period in India and how different it was when India was colonized and how nature was portrayed after colonization. And those two very different realities of how people in power were relating to the environment,
mm-hmm.
and how that changed our perception. And by our, I mean like people in India at the time, how it changed our perception of nature and seeing it as something to love and protect versus seeing it as a commodity, and how that changed our relationship with it, but also changed book history and dissemination and the kind of information that was going out into the world. And so it's a book that for which I'm hoping to get as many things right as possible,
mm-hmm.
and try to do it as well as I can. And that's why it's taking so long, So the paper I'm commissioning, that family that I talked about in Sanganer, Rajasthan, to make all the paper, because that's the kind of paper that would have been used.
Uh-huh.
For the images of the plants that I'm depicting, I'm making the images using wood engraving, multiple blocks wood engraving, and then I'll be giving the printed images to a miniature painter to flourish or finish as he sees fit. So that it's a little bit of a collaboration between today's technology and the methods that were used in that day and age. And the book is a kind of a conversation between these two different cultures that were in that sort of phase of conflict, which is what I just talked about. Mm-hmm. So one part of the book opens right to left, and then the other mm-hmm. part of the book opens left to right, and they both close to make one
whole
kind of quote unquote normal looking book. Yeah, one whole.
Oh, wow. And is there text?
Yeah, there'll be text in English, Hindi, and Urdu.
Oh, wow. And you mentioned using today's technology, but you were talking about wood engraving. So what technology of today are you using?
Okay, I guess by today I really meant
later than the traditional. Yeah. Okay.
So letterpress printing and wood engraving.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Wow. And that'll be an addition?
That'll be an addition, but probably pretty small, just 20 or maybe less, because it's just so much work.
Right. And tell me how you get your artist books out into the world, because I know they are all around.
Yeah, through my website and through just me sending emails to various people and institutions that have my books already
mm-hmm.
and attending book fairs like Codex.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to do it myself as much as possible.
Right. Cool. And we were talking before we got on that we'll both be at Codex in 2022. Knock on wood. Hopefully it happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. And you had a couple of things to recommend. Jim Croft's bone folders.
Yeah. So that's what I use to burnish my paper when I want it to have that sheen and that polish when I'm finishing it for someone that wants to do specifically calligraphy with pen and ink on it. I use his bone folders and he makes special burnishing folders that have a curve and that are thinner on one end. And I've had mine for years and it works great.
And have you actually met Jim? Maybe you can describe meeting him.
Yeah, I actually met him for the first time at that Aramont conference.
Okay. Yeah.
I remember seeing him and I remember thinking, who is this man? He looks so out of place in this like school here.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that he had a jean jacket on that looked very heavy and scruffy and dirty. And a little while later, he came up to me and he started talking to me and we got along. And he noticed I was freezing because it was my first fall in the United States and it was terribly cold for me.
Oh.
And he took off that jacket and he gave it to me and he said, never let the cold get inside your bones. And I didn't take it off and it was the warmest thing. He's just such a great human being. I love him.
Yeah, Jim Croft lives in Idaho and has a place called Old Ways. I think he teaches papermaking and bookmaking, like soup to nuts. You do everything on the land. He and his wife live on the land and grow everything and make paper and harvest everything. And I'm not getting it all right, but he wears a vest also that has bone folders when he's at conferences and events with all these pockets with his bone folders. Says he's collected the bones and made these folders. And he's great.
Yeah. I've always wanted to visit. I mean, he's growing the flax to harvest the fiber, to make the thread, to bind his books, and not to mention to make the paper to put in his books. They're just beautiful.
And hewing the wood to make the covers. It's fantastic. I'll link to him in the show notes too. And then you mentioned a couple of papers that you like to use when you can't make your own paper.
Yeah, so when I don't have the time, or if I know somebody's already doing something well, mm-hmm. and I don't think it's worth trying to replicate it or trying to get the recipe right, then I do buy paper from other paper makers, like Andrea Peterson of Hook Pottery Paper and the Morgan Conservatory in Cleveland, where I worked for a brief spell.
Do you have particular papers? Tell me about a couple papers you've ordered from them.
From the Morgan, I ordered a paper that I helped them make at some point when I was there, uh-huh. which is a very beautiful translucent white abaca, uh-huh. which I used for one of my projects. And so I worked with their lead paper maker there, Michelle Marshall, about the recipe, because that's the recipe that I came up with while I was there, but it needed to be tweaked in order to get what I needed. So they were really helpful in trying to get it right and sent me the paper. It was beautiful. Mm. Yeah.
What was the quality that you needed to tweak? Like, what was the purpose? Yeah,
it wasn't translucent enough. It still looked like it had salt in it. Mm. If you know what I mean. So it just needed to become like dissolved. The salt had been dissolved.
That's a great way of describing it. Yeah. This cloudy look, I would say, but salt. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So yeah, it needed like an hour more, I think.
Uh-huh. Okay. And I want you to tell me about this piece that you just finished, or you're still editioning perhaps, but I've seen it online and I actually saw you post a piece that you made in a class with Kelly Anderson, who is a paper engineer and teaches this paper engineering course through Cooper Union. And that inspired me to take her course, and I'm loving it. And okay, well, this piece, actually, I know you're using an Eric Jurdy construction, but it seems somehow that it came after this course with her. So that's why I mentioned that, but maybe it's totally not related, but tell me about that.
Yeah. It's a piece called Peeping Tom. Mm-hmm. And it's based on an origami tessellation by Eric. And I used it actually because I happened to meet him when I was visiting Cave Paper years ago and house sitting for Amanda
in Minneapolis.
And he was her tenant. And he gave me a copy of his book, and that's the one tessellation that I made and loved. So it's a tessellation that looks, so it turns the entire sheet into a grid, and then you fold the grid further into 9 squares, so which you can pop out. So I'm just taking 3 of those tessellations and adding them together, and then I've already letterpress printed the paper before folding it so that certain colors are highlighted. Mm. When you fold it in that way and pop up those little squares, and then those little squares have stenciled images so that at the end it looks like you're looking into the windows of an apartment building. So the first one that I made was years ago when I was still in Iowa, and it was meant to look like an apartment building in India, and it was this gaudy pink color that people love using on apartment buildings there. And this time, it's another edition. It's called Peeping Tom Blue Edition, and it's blue, and it's apartment building windows in Sweden, because that's where I was also stuck for 9 months of this past year and a half, just looking into apartment buildings and not knowing anyone and looking at what's going on. And so the new images are based off my experiences in Sweden.
Okay. And you mentioned that you live on the border of Sweden. So is that what you mean? Where you live now is actually looking across, or you were somewhere else?
Yeah, the studio is on the border.
Okay.
And where I live now is in the south of Norway.
So when you were at the studio, you were looking? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Sorry, I'm kidding. Just trying to make sense of all the places you are. Okay. Well, Radha, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing your life with paper.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon. There's a reason besides the season.